Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this Thursday, the 14th of August. I'm Joe Donahue, and as our panel starts to file in after a media project taping, we'll get started shortly. But in the meantime, I will remind you that you can always reach us and talk about the topics that we are discussing by going to roundtable at wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org, and you can also go online. You can go to our Facebook page. You can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. These are all acceptable ways of getting a hold of us, and I'm sure we would even accept unacceptable ways. Let us...
Okay.
I don't even know what that means, Paul.
What about Instagram and Pinterest?
There you go. See, that was mean.
Snapchat.
Not to mean that is Snapchat, unacceptable, yeah. But it is. It's a way, right? It's a way. Let me introduce our panel to you. College of St. Rose Communications Professor Paul Conti joins us. Paul, good to have you back. Thank you
for being here. Thank you for the invite.
Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick joins us. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Joe.
And associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, back in the saddle. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Always nice to have you aboard. Again, we welcome your comments, roundtable@wamc.org. Let's go to the news. This is a topic that we discussed yesterday on the program, and it's one that is has remained, and we'll talk about it once again, and that is what is happening in Ferguson, Missouri. There was more violence last night. There was a rally yesterday, and the police department is still being quite mum on details, although some details have emerged. Meanwhile, there were reports last night that two reporters were roughed up, I guess, one from the Huffington Post and the other one from
Washington Post.
And LA Times, right?
And
formerly, I think, of the LA Times.
But right. Washington right. Post? Yeah, yeah. Now yeah. With Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And they were in a McDonald's. And
yes.
They were kind of covering it. Yeah. They were what?
One of the things that they said to them is, "You were trespassing," is why they took them into custody, and they don't know why they were trespassing.
They started taking pictures of the guys with machine guns walking into the McDonald's, and apparently that set it off. And then the one reporter says that the police officers smacked him into a beverage vending machine thing. And so it's still a very unsettled situation. A lot of mixed reports coming out. The New York Times report today talking about the anonymity in police shooting is fueling anger in Missouri. In the 5 days since an unarmed black man was fatally shot by a police officer, the selective release of information about the shooting and especially the anonymity granted to the officer has stoked frustrations in this largely African-American community north of St. Louis, where residents describe increasingly tense relations with police. The police chief, Thomas Jackson, has repeatedly declined to identify the officer who has been put on administrative leave. But on Wednesday, the chief did offer a new detail about the shooting, which has kindled nights of racial unrest and an unyielding police response with tear gas, rubber bullets, and arrests. Chief Jackson said the officer who shot Michael Brown on Saturday was struck in the face during the encounter and treated at a hospital, touching his own cheek. The chief said that a side of the officer's face was swollen from what the police have described as a struggle in which Mr. Brown assaulted the officer and tried to take his gun away, an account disputed by a witness, a friend of Mr. Brown's, who said his hands were raised when the last of several shots were fired. So that is the latest information. I'm not attacking the police department, or at least not intentionally doing that. I am asking the question of if that is the case and if that is the version, then why not say that 4 days ago?
Well, I still think it's incredible that we don't know the officer's name. Here, we would have known this officer's name, I think, the first day or within 24 hours. And I don't know whether this is standard operating procedure in Missouri that this doesn't happen. or why the reluctance to release the name of the officer. I think that would do a lot to at least start to quell this terrible tension that's happening out there.
And in most cases, everyone would know who it is, and it just wouldn't be released. But it would seem to me in this case, if people did know who it was, then it would we'd know. And we don't, which is interesting.
Well, wouldn't one of the fears be that, given the tension out there, that his life could be in danger? I mean, we're assuming it's a his, because he's been using a him pronoun, but
a male pronoun. You know, I hear what you're saying, and that is what they're saying, that because of all the tensions, just for the safety of the officer who has been suspended during this.
Well, I think that's initially understandable, but at this point,
couldn't they protect?
Right.
Somehow.
Yeah. I mean, I understand within the first couple hours, if you see the tension brewing and you say, OK, we're going to put you on administrative leave. We're going to protect you against what could be violent act until we sort this thing out. And then we're going to give your name so people know what's going on.
And so reporters can do some fact checking and find out, has this officer been in trouble like this before, or is he a stellar officer, and to give a little bit more context to this whole situation.
I think it shows the attitude that the police have in this town. And I did see a video today that one of the two reporters took during their arrest or whatever it was. They were kind of being, and the guy was scary looking. I mean, he was all, he was in stormtrooper uniform, and he had, a rifle in his arms, and it wasn't pleasant. So the it just seems like the police are deliberately in your face here. It's not like other towns where they have community relations people and they know how to handle tension, and they are trained to detense things, if that's a word, and it just seems like they're in your face.
The St. Louis alderman, Antonio French, emerged Thursday morning from a night in jail after his arrest at the Ferguson protest to say that the police officer's heavy-handed approach on the streets is making the situation worse. I think that speaks to what you were just saying, Mike. I mean, it does seem that we're adding fuel to the fire here by this increased presence. I guess for a heavy-handed approach, I'm looking at a picture of the tear gas explosion that, quite frankly, is eerily similar to the photos that we've seen over the last couple of days of whether it be in Baghdad or Ukraine or Gaza. I mean, it's an interesting. It's a hard thing to see, and especially that it's happening in a relatively small city outside of St. Louis, and I don't know.
Well,
what the next step is.
I think. Well, the longer the tension level remains where it is, the harder it is going to be to spin it back. I mean,
last night was the fifth night of unrest. So yes, to Mike's point,
Well, first you got to find out what some of the concerns are. One of them is the officer's name. So why continue to sit on that at this point? As Mike pointed out, people are going to know that name somehow. It's actually surprising it hasn't made its way into the media at this point.
Or at least into the Twitter sphere.
Or
on Facebook.
Yeah, someplace.
And it may have. But it would. It would be being transparent right now. Demonstrating everything that's going on to find out what happened and to bring some understanding and justice to this is what they should be doing. And it seems like they're continuing to be thugs.
And by not being transparent about it, it implies or infers that they're not doing anything, that they're not concerned about bringing
justice.
It
does seem that way. It probably isn't that way, but it seems that way. And that's not good.
Yeah, the head scratch is, though, isn't there an elected official that's the supervisor of the police department, ultimately?
Well, the chief did order the release of the two reporters right away.
Yes.
But the governor apparently is heading there today.
But
it's gotten the attention of public officials finally.
Right, but there's got to be some kind of
advocate for the people?
Well, there's got to be an elected. I don't know the incorporated.
The city councilman was arrested.
Yeah, so I assume if it's a city council person, there's an elected mayor.
You know, some comparisons have been made to the civil rights protests of the 1960s, just those images of people protesting and police officers being very militant and in their face, which is a real sad thing to see.
There is a mayor of
Where's the mayor?
Of Ferguson, and the mayor has addressed the attentions, and his name is James Knowles III. He was talking to, he has made several, I guess he does give reports regularly, has not, I guess, you know, as part of the policy of not releasing any more information, because when he does appear at these events, he is press events, he does appear with the police chief. I go back to my original question, which was, they're now saying that there was a scuffle, that the police officer was struck. And I go back to that idea of, okay, well, if that was the case, then why not bring that up on day one? And I don't know what the answer would that be.
A tone deafness, a inability to understand that you have to be completely transparent. You have to say what you know, you have to say what you don't know, and you have to tell people what you're doing to find it out.
Because when you say...
You can't, it almost sounds like they are arguing that the police officer was justified in this. And you can't say that till you know all the facts. But it's coming across that way, and that's outrageous until you know the facts. Whoever's in charge needs to be neutral on this.
And I wonder that if not to say that there wouldn't have been any tension, there probably would have been, but if they had come out early and if this was indeed the case and true, and they said that the officer was struck and there was a scuffle and that we did this and this and we are defending our actions, would that have not brought the tone down quite a bit as opposed to what we're seeing now?
Yeah. Right, because this is not an unusual situation.
Right.
There have been cases, many cases across the country where police officers will shoot someone who is unarmed, and you have seen cities handle it much better.
Los Angeles just last night had a man was killed, an unarmed man, but he was in a scuffle with police. It turned out he had some mental health issues. I mean, different circumstances, but we know everything about it. I mean, I know that much. And it's not causing the stir. I'm sure it'll need to be investigated, and there'll be suspensions, and there'll be an appropriate probe and accountability. But it sounds like they're not even trying to be accountable.
Right. They don't even really care.
Yeah.
There are accounts in the St. Louis Dispatch of talking to young black youth. Let's try that again. Black youth that 19-year-old Jarrett Snyder said he was stopped while walking in his neighborhood. He showed his identification. The officer still called for several backup units. Snyder said, "You get harassed." This is before the incident. He's recalling things that happened earlier. "You get harassed." Snyder, who lives in an apartment complex near where Brown was shot, described himself as a good friend of Brown. "It's too much. Mike's situation is not the first time." Stephen Busey, of 29 years old, said he was recently stopped by an officer while walking to a convenience store before his pre-dawn shift at a fast food restaurant. "The cop asked me why I was out so early and said I looked like a guy who robbed a bank nearby. I didn't make a big deal about it, but since when is walking a crime?" Again, there were more backup units called in. So you get in, of course, Ferguson is being singled out, but you get into not only a culture here, but an overall police culture that is that I think has been simmering for a long time, which would certainly make sense as to why this type of tension is erupting over the last 5 nights.
You know, and St. Louis does a lot of studies on racial profiling, but apparently they just do the studies and they don't do anything else. You know, another year, another study, put it on a shelf.
But that's St. Louis.
This is a small suburb that used to be 99% white and now is 80% minority. And it has been tense there for quite a while, and that this would happen is not that the aftermath of this terrible tragedy that happened, you know, is not a surprise to people. That this just demonstrates the bad relationship the authorities have with the residents.
I was struck by the the statement that was made yesterday of saying that the police officer was struck in the face and then he had to be treated at a hospital, and okay. But then Why do you have to shoot him, right? I mean, it still doesn't, like, you still don't, it still doesn't make sense, you know, and there's key parts of that that are missing, and it doesn't make a lot of sense.
I have to say, in most cities, if it happened in a community around here, the guy would be suspended. You'd hear everything that they know. There would be an inquest right away. They would bring people in to help, you know, talk about this and get it out. Everybody would be talking about it. They would be available to the media. There would be public meetings where people could ask questions. And that's how you handle something like that. Doesn't seem like much of that's been happening.
What if it's a black officer?
Is it relevant? I mean, if it's a fact, it should be known, and that becomes part of the discussion, whether it's a black officer who shot a black kid or a white officer that shot a white kid or whatever. Whatever is pertinent should be known, but they shouldn't take a stance. It sounds like when they come out with the information that he was injured and he was taken to the hospital, that they're defending it. And that really, boy, that can't come across well.
I mean, to the question that you asked Paul earlier to kind of answer the impossible of, like, you know, how do you unwind all of this now? And it'll be interesting to see over what happens over the next several
month.
Days. Somebody else
has to take over, and then maybe that's why the governor's going today, and maybe he's going to appoint some high level commission to just come in there and get to the bottom of it and to be transparent and to desensitize. I mean, that's probably a good effort, you know.
And, of course, the FBI, we mentioned yesterday, the FBI has started their federal investigation. So, and
full cooperation with everybody, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I mean, has the funeral of the young man been held yet?
I don't believe so.
That will be another event.
Yeah, certainly.
And well, I don't know if that's going to diffuse or raise.
Right, I think it will.
Well,
will
I mean,
not diffuse.
Then efforts have to be taken to make sure that people are allowed to grieve and that's done and not doesn't become an
don't option. Sit back.
Sorry, we didn't warn you on that. I apologize.
They have the ejector seat over here at the end of the podium. Whoa.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about other stories, and we do welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Paul Conte, Judy Patrick, and Mike Spain with us this morning in the panel. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel for this Thursday morning. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. We have been talking about the violence in Ferguson, Missouri, and we have a lot of letters on that subject. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let me reintroduce our panel to you. Associate Editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, is here. Editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick, joins us, as does College of St. Rose Communications Professor Paul Conte. Thank you all again for being with us. Let's go through the letters. James writes, almost seems like they are keeping quiet while they are trying to work out a favorable story. Michael says maybe he was waiting for some sort of investigation to be completed before the mayor said anything, or from the police delay before they said anything. Shelley says, you all seem to speak as if the police department is at fault. This is the tone of your conversation. We have no idea what it is like to be a police officer in the streets of what is obviously a dangerous area of the country. If you live the day in and day out dangers of dealing with these people, you might try to sympathize more with law enforcement. We all sit in our safe houses and judge. Please speak about both sides. Anyone want to comment on that? I think our question is less about the police behavior and more about the lack of information that we have.
They did not come across as being objective by the way that they shielded the police from it and the way they parsed out the information and just the behavior of what happened in the McDonald's with the two reporters sort of underscores the tension that the police have with the community. They certainly recognize the dangers of the police. It's a very difficult job, and you need to defend your police when they're being challenged. But in this particular case, you have to have someone who's neutral, who wants to take out the tension and just be objective about it. And that's what's called for. That's all.
Ryan writes, the other thing that doesn't add up about the police story is, why would a young kid who had so much ahead of him, college, etc., get into a fight with a police officer? Why would he go for his gun? And then people are saying he's a kind, nice kid. It just doesn't add up. Mike writes to us and says, I'm concerned by the pictures I see about this event. The police are so up-armored and aggressive. This posturing is in-your-face and adversarial. It's a disturbing trend that needs to be addressed. Makes you wonder what's going on in law enforcement. We got this from Scott, who writes, the entire episode is heartbreaking. The police are being demonized, and the citizens are feeling terrorized. There are likely no winners here. Gina writes, the officer went to hospital for a puffy cheek, and they left Mike Brown in the street for 4.5 hours. Also, it appears that when the officer tried to open his door to close to the boys, it slammed back into him. That could be how he was hit in the face. Also, Anonymous did post a picture of the officer. He is white. Jen says, does stupidity by the police justify the looting of Ferguson? Both sides, black and white, are acting abominably. It doesn't matter how angry one is, what injustice has been done. It does not give anyone the right to burn and loot and destroy. The behavior of both sides in this conflict only enhances and feeds the horrible stereotypes that started this mess in the first place. It is outrageous, and it keeps twisting and turning. Noah writes to a previous letter writer, what do you mean, these people? I think that is it for our letters. Roundtable at WAMC.org if you would like to join in on the conversation or have anything to say on this or other issues. And we also got this one from Tom, who says, seems to be about a police department out of control against the community. Police seem to have declared war against the community of Ferguson. Again, we welcome your comments as well. We'll go back to other issues that are making news and are being talked about, and we'll go with the idea of ground troops in Iraq. This was something that was brought up yesterday. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, speaking to reporters, talked about the situation and said that there are many, they're starting to consider many options. And one of those options is to have troops, boots on the ground, some 130 troops already part of the situation in a in Iraq, who are in a humanitarian effort there, which has only fueled a speculation that more troops will be called in. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, France, Britain, and Germany all said that they would increase their effort to aid people stranded on the mountain as well. And so, as I believe August 10th was the last time the president made a statement saying that there would, under no circumstances, be boots on the ground. And slowly it seems that is being put into question. And I think at the time we mentioned that is it a good thing to make a definitive statement like that?
On the other hand, if you equivocate.
Right.
Hey, he left himself a garage door. He could drive a truck through. You know, so I don't know that there's a win on that, but you can't. I guess he doesn't have a crystal ball in the White House anywhere.
Yeah.
Apparently the crisis on the mountaintop has alleviated a bit. Many of the people on the top have been able to escape off the mountain and head north.
They believe they've broken the siege, yeah.
Which is good news, but man, it does. I just hope that somewhere somebody is, or a group of people are getting together and having a more comprehensive strategy about how to deal with this escalating situation in Iraq.
I agree. I think that's the perception that is coming out, that there isn't a firm plan. There's not any strong leadership. And yet nobody has come up with an idea that sounds good. You know,
no.
The neocons want to march in, you
right.
know, with the troops and get back into Iraq. And others want to be completely isolated from it. And that's their problem. Let them solve it no matter what. And it's a changing situation. And that's about all you can say. And the president, if he puts down a firm statement one day, there has to be an exception to the rule, and he has to know when to do that. And it's not helping him. I mean, at all. You know, he's looking weak, he's looking undecisive, and it's a tough situation.
The latest twist came hours after Benjamin Rhodes, deputy national security advisor, told reporters on Martha's Vineyard, where President Obama is vacationing, that the president was likely to receive recommendations about how to mount a rescue operation in the next several days. He said those recommendations could have included the use of American ground troops. So that is what has sort of started this. Mr. Rhodes made those comments as the secret team of Marines and Special Operation Forces were already on the mountain in the middle of a 24-hour trip to talk to the displaced people and the fighters. So to your point, Mike, of, you know, trying to figure out what's next and then how you try to regain some.
And there's politicians ground. Who are making – you know, getting some ground on this also and making the president look bad is good for anybody who wants to replace him in a couple of years.
I just think it's, you know, whenever we discuss these things, somebody ought to put a price tag on it because, I mean, at least that ought to be in the equation. I'm not saying we shouldn't do anything that we're doing, but we never talk about what is this costing. It's not cheap to put aircraft in the air. It's not cheap to fire weapons. Those are expensive things to purchase. They're consumables. Mm-hmm. They go away when you fire them. We just ran two wars on credit.
Right.
And there's talk of further arming the Kurdish rebels, and that too will have a cost.
Right.
A significant cost.
Right.
Did anyone find it just slightly amusing / not ironic that Hillary Clinton's book tour brought her to Martha's Vineyard yesterday?
Where they have their little hug up. Is that the term?
She was going to hug it out.
Hug it out.
Hug it out. But.
And she sold 1,200 books. So a hug and 1,200 books sold.
I got to tell you, that's her audience.
Absolutely.
People summering at Martha's Vineyard.
That's it.
Can I just observe, though, that what kind of a vacation does a president of the United States actually get to have? I mean, seriously,
Paulie gets out on the links, he gets some fresh air.
And in between security briefings and phone calls and about what's happening in Ferguson.
Look at all the brush that George W. Bush cleared during his vacations every August when he was president.
You make a very good point as far as you bring the White House with you, which you're expected to do.
Right.
But then you still take criticism for, quote unquote, being on vacation. Even though you're still president, no matter what.
I know. No, it's just, I don't know what to do about it or what the observation means, but it just seems like, wow, you don't get much time. You don't get downtime in that job at all.
You know, I think if you're president, maybe you don't take vacation for 4 years.
Eight. That sounds easy.
I love the pictures of each president when they take office and when they leave office and how old they look and their hair is all gray.
You don't really love them. They're just astounding pictures. They really are.
Better put.
Shock.
And maybe the answer, Judy, is just day trips.
And they do take a lot of
staycations.
Right. Well, staycations.
They did a date night in New York one time, went to a dinner and a play, and, you know, all those stories were about $8 million and it cost to fly them up there and have all the security in place and everything. It's tough.
Well, I as a person who could not attend a play because the president was attending the one I had tickets for, I would say that it can be annoying, but I understand. They took care of us. They gave us other tickets. That's fine. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we will move on to other stories. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support comes from Field Goods, delivering fresh produce from local farms for pickups at workplaces or community sites from Saratoga to Yonkers. Field-goods.com. Omai International Arts Center, Ghent, New York. Dancers in residence showing in the Field Sculpture Park, Saturday, August 23rd from 2 to 4 p.m., open to the public. ArtOmai.org. And Third Eye Associates Limited, life planning, transition planning, and wealth management, registered investment advisors with offices in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Red Hook, New York. ThirdEyeAssociates.com.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel, Paul Conte, Mike Spain, and Judy Patrick joining us this morning. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org. We're going to move from the world stage for a moment and look at what is happening in, or what had perhaps happened in Albany regarding the casino plan that we heard so much about.
Yeah, the promoters of the casino, the Hard Rock Cafe / casino for the city of Rensselaer, right across from downtown Albany, are trying to enlist the support of the city of Albany and have made an offer that if the city supports their casino plan, Albany will get $1 million a year in payments and some training and some job prospects for city residents, and that will be for 10 years. Meanwhile, the mayor, Kathy Sheehan, says hold off because we're expecting a proposal from the promoters of another casino that's going in Rensselaer County, just up the hill from Rensselaer in the town of East Greenbush, and that site also is expected to make some kind of a offer to the city to enlist their support. And then, of course, there's two more in contention, one in Howes Caves in Schoharie County, and a big project done being proposed by Galesi Group in downtown Schenectady. And that we're coming down to the wire. They're having public hearings, what, in September now, Judy?
That's correct.
Yeah. And they could make a decision soon after these public hearings. And
you think they'll make a decision before November?
I have this image of a politician putting a shovel in the ground somewhere in the greater capital region.
Before Election Day.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, one of the questions I've had, Saratoga County, their Board of Supervisors also was considering endorsing one of the sites. And like, why does it matter what Albany County support or which one Albany County supports? Is that part of the application? Does that give them a better chance of winning approval from the Gaming Commission?
The purpose of this casino referendum was to promote economic vitality in areas that need it. So if Rensselaer is going to share their wealth with the city of Albany across the river, just a stone's throw, it probably would look good because the city of Albany has unemployment. The city of Albany had a plan themselves. In fact, the developer in Rensselaer is one who had proposed one for Exit 23 a few months ago off in the city of Albany, but the land turned out not to be developable, and they scrapped that plan.
Oops.
Yes, right. I guess they didn't look at the land close enough. But anyway, so to include a city that has economic problems probably would look well if that is the criteria that the committee is going to use, or the Gaming Commission is going to use, Siting Commission.
Well, isn't the play from the mayor's end just sit and wait?
Well, she wants to hear what others have to offer.
Right.
And
what I do.
As Jordan's story points out,
see what else
and
comes
I would
in.
Be surprised. They're not expecting any offer from the Galesi Group in Schenectady. They've already have their deals going on with the city of Schenectady and venues in Schenectady.
Yeah, but everybody wants money from these proposed casinos.
It sounds like they're just going to be bringing in tons and tons of dollars. And that's not really true, though, is it?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, where will we put it off?
Right. You know, people are thinking of paved streets, lower taxes, better schools. And, you know, they just closed another casino this week in Atlantic City.
Oh, the Revel.
Yeah.
And that is an amazing story of just a doomed project from the very beginning, it seems.
Yeah, and it was unusual, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, they sort of went bankrupt halfway into building it and then came out of it and said, you know, everything will be fine. And then it wasn't. And I guess a year and a half after it opened, I believe September 10th. September 10th will be their last day open, and then it will be closed, and no one has come forward to buy it. But I believe however billions of dollars.
There's a lot more competition, though, in the sort of a geographic area.
Right.
Atlantic City was the only gaming game in the sort of northeast, but now you got two large casino operations in Connecticut. You've got one up the road a piece here in
Turning
New York
Stone,
State.
Yeah. State, New York, yep.
Right, so you've got casino business that can compete, and they also have land.
Hmm.
You know, so I don't know. I don't know that Atlantic City's fortunes are going to get any better, especially if New York State goes ahead and approves several other casinos.
Well, a recent study showed that most of the traffic or most of the consumers of the casinos will be from the region where the casino's located. These are not likely to be destinations. People aren't going to come to Albany from, you know, Boston or from Pennsylvania or Buffalo to go gambling here. You know,
agreed.
It might be on their
But at the same
trip.
Time,
yeah.
They don't need to get on a bus to go to Atlantic City anymore.
Oh, it's going to hurt. I agree. It is hurting.
It certainly is. So what is the timeline now that we're waiting on? Where are we now in the whole?
Well, there's public hearings
thing?
In September where yep. each one will get like 45 minutes to talk about it, and more details are coming out. I saw in the Daily Gazette today that the Schenectady one will be posted online so people can look at all the details, and this vetting is continuing, and then the siting committee will make recommendations in the fall, you know, could be sometime in September. And that would, Paul, allow there to be a ceremonial groundbreaking, perhaps, in four different locations around the state, or five different locations, because the Hudson Valley gets two.
Yeah, it's surprising. Given the fact that most of these proposals have some measure of polarizing, I mean, the one in East Greenbush is, I think, the most polarizing currently. But I don't know about the Schenectady one as much.
Not so much, but the idea being that you're going to alienate some voters as well as make other voters happy. So
yeah. So which side does – a lot of these elections are decided by small numbers overall. Not so much Assembly and Senate seats, but local races. As someone who – keeps track of those things, the margins are frequently pretty small.
Well, Senator
overall.
John Bonachek last night said complained that Governor Cuomo was allowing Orange County to be included in the Catskill region where they're going to site two casinos. And he's complaining because he wants to see them in the Catskills in Ulster County or Sullivan County and not in Orange County, which is much closer to New York. It would kind of erase the value of it. And he says that was so Cuomo could get campaign contributions from the developers of the Orange County proposals. And so it's really heating up and getting kind of nasty. They've already knocked one plan out in our region in Amsterdam.
Wait a minute. An elected state senator in New York is complaining about how campaign contributions are – I'm sorry.
Are you being a little cynical about that?
Well, yes, to be frank, yeah.
Well, we'll allow that to be the last word of today. My thanks to our panel this morning, Paul Conte, Judy Patrick, and Mike Spain. Thank you all very much for being here. A great pleasure. We welcome your comments as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.